Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the H1 podcast. Today, I have my fellow podcast buddy, Alex Murley, on. Unfortunately, Jake is stuck on the way back from, I think, Heathrow, stuck with the normal rubbish nowadays of trying to get back in the country with coronavirus. So how you doing, mate?
Yeah, I'm good, podcast buddy.
You like that little intro?
Yeah, that was a good one. I'm good, thanks. Jake's been stuck in the quarantine queue from Heathrow. So
it's just me and you leading the way.
I know, I can't remember last time me, you and Jake actually did an episode all together. It was the Jordan episode the other day, but
yeah, we need to make that longer, mate.
More regular, that's what I'm saying, though. We need to be the three of us again. But
exactly right.
But today, we've got the day I've been waiting for. This entire podcast, we've had driver after driver after driver. And it's not been a bad thing. I've learned a lot, but it's time to get another two-wheel enthusiast on it who can join me and understand my language. And that is a new rookie to the British Superbike class next year. It's Brad Jones. How you doing, Brad?
Yeah, very well. Thank you. Thanks for having me on the podcast. Look forward to chatting with you guys.
No worries at all. No, it's as I said, it's so nice to have somebody else on.
It'll be me doing the learning this time, and actually I'm quite looking forward to it as well, to be honest with you boys, because I don't know enough about bikes apart from I fall off them more often than Alex does, which is saying something. So
it's a good amount then.
Learn as much as I can from you guys to see if I can brush up on the old skills a little bit.
Exactly. So we'll just touch on the BSB thing to start with, a little amount, tiny amount, because we've got because I'm the odd one out here not being a BMW boy.
There we go.
You two, you got your four-wheel and the two-wheel counterpart today. So it's, I think we can talk a bit about Nick's new M4 that's coming out maybe in a Brad's new M1000RR.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Brad, you take it away first. How's it been? Obviously, we're going to talk about it briefly, but how's it been stepping up to the British Superbike? Transition from there. I don't actually know too much about it, so you're going to have to inform me a little bit, but I guess power's better, everything's a bit better, brakes are better, tyres are better. So how's it been on your first couple of days out?
Yeah, it's been good. Obviously, I'd done the deal to race the Superbike way back in November. So it's been like all over winter, Christmas and everything, where I'd normally be on a bike like early January. And I've had to wait until only just a couple of weeks ago, where I did 3 days. Did Cadwell. Cadwell was the first time out on the 1000cc, which probably wasn't the best idea, really. The narrowest track in the UK, 6 months off the bike and stepping onto a 1000. But to be fair, it went well. So yeah, did a day there, then went to Walton the following day, then ran the week off at Snetterton. So it was good. The transition, I was riding a stock spec S1000RR, so it's not the new M1000. Because they're not as easily available at the minute, but my team PR and they're sort of tied in with a dealership in Preston called Bowker, who supplied me a bike. So it's basically a stock road bike out of the showroom, just with a set of race fairings off. So I think it even still had heated grips on. So it was nice. Like own stock, but even in that sort of trim, it was unbelievable. Obviously, I haven't ridden for 6 months, so it was going to sort of knock my socks off anyway, but. And I think the top end speed wasn't really intimidating, but it was the torque and the power and how it got there, which was the bit that was sort of like, which is what I'm going to need to learn, is how to sort of tame that and then make the most of it at the same time. So, but I think the transition would be good. It's just learning to adapt different lines, different styles. So, but that's all part of the learning process, really.
Nick's also going to have a learning process today with what we're talking about. He's going to style.
It's interesting. Yeah, very interesting. But actually, you can cross-correlate that quite a bit because, when I went, say, from GP2 to F1 for the first time, top speeds, yes, they are slightly different, but not hugely. It was always actually the way you got there. So then you had to manipulate the car and you're talking on two wheels, the bike, in a slightly different way through the corner in order to use that power getting up to top speed. So yeah, there's definitely cross correlations. I can kind of understand what you nutters are on about.
So I think we'll start at the end to go back to the beginning to come to the end again, like a weird story. But let's talk about last year, Brad, because obviously you're going to be stepping up into BSB this year. But last year you raced in the British Supersport Championship like you have done for the few years before. And I think it was a really good, solid year for you last year.
Yeah, last year, when I look back at it, it was difficult, you know, because 2019 for me was probably my standout year in my career in terms of how I developed as a rider. Did a few different races here and there, World Supersport, IDM, and I felt like I really developed. And I finished second in that year to Jack Kennedy. So obviously he moved on. So for 2020, I moved into the sort of British Supersport Championship as the sort of favourite, if you like. So, but things didn't start off great, to be fair. With lockdown and everything, obviously had a long layoff again. Wasn't riding nowhere near as what I was used to. But to be fair, everyone was in the same position. So, you know, it is what it is. But then went to the first official test of the year and crashed at Craner at the end of the first session. Pretty much, well, I wrote the bike off. So wrote most of the day off. Did get back out in the last session, but it just didn't feel right. And like the first three rounds just didn't feel great at all, really. Just struggling with the bike. The bike wasn't reacting in the way that I was used to as towards the previous year. And, you know, we'd ended up doing the first two rounds really struggling, like way off the pace. I mean, I went to Snetton, where I was really strong the year before. I didn't win, but the lap times were really strong. And at Snetton, I was like 1.5 seconds off my best, what I did there previous. And I was like absolutely busting my balls to do the lap time that I was doing. It was like, it was at that point I was like, something ain't right here. Do you know what I mean? So we sat down, looked things through and figured, you know, the bike wasn't quite right. And we changed a few parts here and there. And so then for like the third round of the season, which was Silverstone. But by that point, we're a 6-round championship. We've done 2 rounds. We've got 4 left. So my teammate, Rory, was sort of into his stride already, winning race. I think he won every race by that point. So I didn't start off great. The first 4 races obviously weren't good, as I just said. But then Silverstone was a turning point, back on the podium. And we started gathering some form. And then round 4, I won my first race of the season. So then we started gathering a bit of pace. But by that point, it was too much too late. But did manage to claw it back and finish second again, which obviously wasn't the goal. But after the start of the year and how testing the first few rounds went, actually turned out to be a reasonable result in the end, to be fair.
Yeah, because it was for me, you know, I from the outside, I couldn't really understand why you weren't absolutely up there, because it was, you know, Rory's a really young talent, Nick, who's raced, he's got vast experience racing in Europe, Junior World Championship, Red Bull Rookies, and Rory came back to England a couple of seasons ago to race in Supersport. Stock sticks and stuff, and really gathered momentum and joined the Apple Yard squad. Was it last year he joined?
Yeah, so 2020 was his first year. Yeah, Robin signed him up at the end of 2019 because he showed a bit of promise. And then, yeah, signed up for 2020, and he had a really strong year, to be fair.
Yeah, I think
it does work like that, doesn't it? If you've got someone that's coming in, you know, fresh and with no expectations of himself or from anyone else, sometimes they can come in and just blow your doors off for the first few races. You know, exactly. Look at Leclerc and Vettel. Look at Ricciardo and Vettel. You know, some young shots come in and then it's taken a while for him to, you know, to sort everything out because they've got no pressure on their shoulders. So sometimes it does. I've had the same situation in my junior career as well, where some talents come in and I've been like, oh, Jesus, right, okay. And it doesn't work your way for the first few rounds. And then obviously you get your stuff together. And then obviously you show your class at the end of the season, which it clearly looks like you did. And from my side, obviously, knowing we have a mutual sponsor, actually, which we can chat about a bit later in the podcast. But I do follow what you're doing a fair bit through either Joe or my dad. So, yeah, I knew what you were up to and how the season was going anyway.
Yeah, that's right. I think exactly like you said, it's like when you're in the team, it's almost like within the team is always, although the team say there isn't, but there's always feels like there's that sort of like hierarchy. It's like he's expected to do this, he's expected to do this. And obviously my job was I was expected to win. So having the few issues that I had at the start of the season, with that added pressure on top, the two just really didn't go together. It was like butting heads, really. But, you know, after I got my head around it, you know, realised what was what. And as you say, we soon got things back on track. But Like you say, it does happen though, doesn't it? You see it all the time. Same amount of GP World Superbikes, it happens, doesn't it?
Yeah, even to the greats, like even to the really, really good people. And particularly the first couple of times it happens. And then you sort of, when you kind of half expect someone to come in and just ride free. So, and particularly from my point of view anyway, if you're riding free, unlike driving free, it must be even more of an advantage, because being tensed up on a bike just can't be fast at all. Because I know it's not in a car, and a bike is much more sensitive in terms of pitch and platform. From the outside, me looking at the inputs. So if you're riding, thinking, right, I need to really push out this lap here, it can't be any good. And with that pressure, I'm sure that's something that you tend to do.
Yeah, like when I'm racing, I know, I always tell myself I'm riding tight, which is the exact same as what you would probably say is, you know, you need to ride free or drive free. It's the exact same thing, like saying riding tight on the bike, you just can't get it to turn. There's no flow, which we've talked about, you know, previously. You just don't get that. To ride free is worth so much, and that's a lot of that as a mindset thing as well. So
100%. But as you know, the 2019 season progressed and 2020 season progressed, as you said, and I really think that win at, like, was it Alton you got your first win at?
Alton round four sprint race on the Saturday afternoon. It was good. I enjoyed that.
I watched that one. I was watching that one on TV and I thought, yes. You know,
yeah, that was proper sweet, that one. Obviously, winning's great anyway, but going through a difficult first few races and then to sort of bring it all back. That was good, that was. But to be fair, like Alton is one of my strongest tracks anyway, but it all come together at the right time, you know. That was a good time. It was like riding the wave sort of thing, which was good.
Yeah, like I don't know if you can say or you can't say, it doesn't matter if you can't, but what parts did you have to change on the bike?
Yeah, it was a chassis thing basically. So it was to do with geometry and things like that. So the changes we were putting into the bike, it just wasn't reacting in the way that. So I just could not turn the thing, especially in the fast corner. I could not commit to the front at all. So we just basically went through, changed loads of bits, and we figured out what was what. So we'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I've crashed some bikes in the past, as I'm sure you know, Nick. one of my training bikes, I used to use the CBR 500 to train on quite a lot, and that had a bent chassis, and it'd be like, I'm going around these left-handers, and I'm like, it's absolutely mint.
Yeah,
the thing turns like anything. And then you go into the right and it's like, oh, I'm going straight here. This just doesn't turn at all.
Yeah,
that's just the CB 500 out of the factory.
Yeah. Exactly. But it's, you know, I think you did a great job to finish off the year strong. And I think that showed in your in what's going to be coming for 2020 for you. But let's, as I said, we're going to start at the end and go to the beginning. Let's start right to start your career. So how did you get into motorbikes for one and racing for two?
So racing in my family is like a big thing. All my uncles used to race, my dad, like motocross mainly, but my dad's done all sorts of things, motocross, stock cars. And then all I remember him doing is road racing, really, because that's what he was doing when I was born. I did schoolboy motocross to start off with, purely because my cousin, who's similar age to me, we always used to knock around together. He was doing motocross, so it was like, right, I need to be doing motocross. That's what he's doing, so that's what I need to be doing. So did that, schoolboy stuff, just club based, you know, club level sort of stuff. I was okay and reasonable, but at the end of 2009, I went to Rockingham. There's a Thundersport meet in there. I went to watch it. It was like, just basically to see if I liked it, even like the look of it. And it was like, right, we'll have a look at this. I think we looked at plenty of bikes whilst we were there, because it was the end of the season. So there was plenty of like lads selling bikes off. Didn't pick one up there, but we picked one up from Bemsey, I think. Do you remember Jordan Simpkin?
Yes. Because he also raced with number 18, I think.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. What's going back?
Yeah, that is going back. So
Jordan still doing anything now?
No, not anymore. He was like, I think I don't know what happened, but I think he won the Superstock 600 championship, had a go at sort of Superstock 1000, and And then I don't really know where he went after that, to be fair. But he was super quick at the time.
Yeah, he was. It was early teens he won stock six, wasn't it? Sort of like 13, yeah. 14.
Yeah, it would have been about that. I think it might have been 14, to be fair. Maybe 13. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah,
but yeah, that's where it was started. So I bought his 125, did the Aprilia Super Team things for 2 years. Really good. I remember my first race, I think I finished 2 from last, something like that. And then by the end of the season, we sort of worked up through and I was sort of finishing. They had the newcomers championship back then.
Yeah.
So it was like the newcomers championship within the main championship. So towards the end of that year, I started getting on the podium of the newcomers championship. And then, 2011. Go on.
Because for Nick, there was a couple of different directions into road racing. And to track racing. So, and one of the main ones, which we'll just talk about, is Aprilia Super Teams, which Brad's said he's done. Now, the Aprilia Super Teams Championship, oh, do you know when it started, Brad?
It was years ago. I know, like, lads like Cal Crutchlow, Chaz Davis, Tom Sykes, Camier,
Casey Stoner.
Came over, did it.
Proper
name. He lived at Ian Newton's place. So, it was way back now.
It was the breeding ground for all those names. It was absolutely, it was a brilliant championship because it was a low cost formula to get guys racing on proper circuits around the UK. And as Brad said, a lot of successful names have come out of it. So, and I did the, so there was a, in 2013, 2012, we saw a big transition in racing, in the world championship. It went from 125s to Moto 3, which we see nowadays. And it went from 250s to Moto 2, which we see now. So the big switch was 2-stroke to 4-stroke. And it was environmental reasons.
Yeah.
But it was, also the
still spitting out fuel, but yeah, environmental reasons. Yeah.
I remember at the time it was a big thing, wasn't it? People were you can't get rid of 2-stroke, 2-stroke's where it's at, 4-stroke's never gonna cut it. Mm. But you look at it now, it's 4-stroke is so advanced and you can do so much with it. It was the way forward, although at the time it was a big job.
Exactly, it felt wrong at the time, didn't
yeah.
it? It was
I suppose it's like electric car racing, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
Formula E series, stuff like that. At the time, when it first comes out, you look at it and think, now surely it won't work, but it does, doesn't it?
Yeah, it seems to be. I mean, I've been on, so haven't done motocross at any time, but I've been on some people's bikes that have a motocross bike and I've just stupidly got on. So an 85 big wheel, my girlfriend's little brother had a little go on that. And then my friend actually used to race bikes, but enduro motocross as well. And I remember he had a 450 4-stroke, and I can't remember, I think it was a KTM. Jesus, man. I started it and he's like, make sure you start in second. So I started in second. The torque difference was the main thing. I put in what felt like 0.01 of a millimeter and I thought I was going to fall off the back because there was so much power. It was just unbelievable. So with riding style as well, did you guys, I know you might not have necessarily done the transition from 2-stroke to 4-stroke in Moto 2 or Moto 3 or whatever, but did you or do you find a huge difference from that in terms of rideability as well?
I'll let Brad answer this one because I did the 2-strokes on kart circuits and only on big tracks. I've only ever rode a 4-stroke.
Copy that.
Yeah. So for me, I went from a 125, which is obviously single cylinder. And then the year after that, so the first 4-stroke I rode was then a V-twin, 450. So the biggest thing that I noticed with the 2-stroke to 4-stroke is you hold the throttle flat out down the straight and you shut it off with a 2-stroke. You're it's like driving a car into a turn with the clutch in neutral, just free roll. Whereas a 4-stroke, it's going down the straight in your car in fifth gear and then just bang it straight into second or something like that. It was that inertia, that engine braking, that was the biggest difference for me. But then, to be fair, at the time when I went from 2-stroke to 4-stroke, I was relatively inexperienced in racing motorbikes anyway. So it was hard for me to adapt. I just kept riding the thing and then it became a natural sort of habit.
How many years did you do in Super Teens?
Only two. I did 2010 and 2011, and then 2013 was when I did the RRV 450, which was like the stepping stone from Super Teens, all within Thundersport. So, because
as Brad said, so there was a Thundersport and Bemsy were two of the biggest club championships in the UK. I was a Bemsy lad, so opposite sides of the fence, But the RRV 450 Championship, we're going to go into a bit nerdy today with bikes because,
come on,
we've got a bike guest on, man. I'm getting my revenge.
You're getting your own back.
Yeah. It was a really interesting championship because they, Brad can talk a little bit more about this than me, but they were a really lightweight bike, but with a really good amount of power. I think they had about 60 brake horsepower, somewhere around.
Between 50 and 60. The early versions didn't have had about 50, and like anything, as things developed, they started touching 60, I think. Yeah, so reasonable amount of power for a super lightweight bike.
Yeah, exactly. And they were, a super lightweight for a proper race bike. And it created a championship which had really close racing. But you've almost got this prototype sort of bike that was really, really nimble handling, but then had the grunt down the straights. And it had a really cool underseat exhaust.
Yeah, it's a cool looking thing.
It was a really cool looking thing. And then, some of the guys, Brad, who did you race in that championship, Brad?
There's some good lads in it. Jake Dixon... I think he moved on the year before me, but he came through it. But I raced against people like Ross Twyman, Tom Oliver, David Allingham. There was like 10 good lads in it. There was, you could either be first or 10th. You know what I mean? There was such that depth of field at the time. Some super good lads and super talented kids that never went on much further than that, but they were super talented. And I'm sure if they'd had the right opportunities or the right budget at the time, they would have gone a long way. It was producing some really good riders at the time.
Yeah, as Brad said, likes of Jake Dixon, who's in Moto2 World Championship now. It was a great, great championship.
He's with Petronas, right? I think I've heard that name.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Then I have heard that name. So, it's funny what you say also with the obviously it cross-correlates once again, and I'll keep bringing that up because it's quite interesting for the listeners. It's always you have these particular people, I had them in karting or in my junior formula as well, that you think, what happens if he had just had that one little opportunity or that one little break or that extra X amount of cash just to do that next year, where they'd have been then? Because I think a lot of people, unlike football, where, 99.9% of people or parents can go and fund a pair of football boots for their kid and buy a football, and they can practice as much as they want, and if they're good, they're good. In any forms of motorsport or horse riding, expensive sports, it's not just about the kid being good. It's about how things fall and different opportunities come about. And it's interesting to hear that both of you have had that experience in the bike world as well.
Mm. Yeah, you see it a lot. Even there's lads that I look back that have made it to British Championship, had some success, and then followed up by maybe a poor year or two. Then you look around, all of a sudden, they're gone, they've finished their racing careers. And I think that happens across the board, doesn't it? Across all sports and motorsports especially.
Yeah. Cutthroat.
It is.
Very cutthroat. Yeah.
All the way through career as well. Like, as you said, there's probably lads you've raced in Super Sport, Brad, that and now not really there.
Yeah, there's people that spring to mind Saturday now that I think about, that won championships in British Superstar. And moved on. And that we're only talking, it's like there's a lad, Dan Stamp, he won the Superstock 600 Championship 2017. And now I know he's had a couple of years away from the racing now, and it's just how it goes. It's like Nick said, it's so cutthroat that if things don't go your way or you get injured at the wrong time, it can soon be all over. So you just, just got to, keep on plugging away at it.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And then so once you'd finished in the 450 championship and got your grounding there, you decided to move into the BSB arena and move into Stock 600. So that was 2015. And
yeah, so the year before that, I should probably add, I did a year of club racing on a 600. at Thunder Sport. So I was just turned 16 at the time. And then, yeah, jumped on a 600. I remember getting on the 600 the first time. Again, finished, I think, 16th, 17th in my first club 600 race. Mm. And I thought I was riding the absolute wheels off the thing. There's no chance I can go any faster than that. How am I going to go any faster? But again, things developed. It, you know, got a little bit better. I did the best thing I ever done was doing a British Superstock 600 wildcard in 2014. Because what I learned in that weekend, just one weekend alone, was more than I'd learned all season club racing. Just because you're riding with just a higher level of riders, that's all. I remember going back to the club race maybe 2 weekends after my wildcard. I did the wildcard at Silverstone. And I think I won the first race and finished second in the second race. So that was like by far much better results than what I was having previous. So it was from that point onwards, it was like, right, 2015, we need to be in, like, move up to British Championship. But just me and my dad did it out of the back of the van, really. It was just me and him. I was, like, on the tools, relatively changing wheels, doing fuel bits and bobs. So it was, like, getting stuck in. But as I said previously, it's like we got to a point where we couldn't go no further because we were limited in terms of knowledge of bike setup. Because it's like anything at that level, same with being like karting or cars, I would imagine you get to that level and your knowledge of bike or car setup then limits you, so you need people around you that can take you to that next step.
For sure, yeah, you need a team built around you. I mean, the difference is, I would say in your guys' sport is you can probably go slightly longer. So for karting, yes, you can do a basic setup with your dad all day long. But if you're then going to go to 2 litre Renault, which is the junior single seaters, by that point, and it's probably why cost is more when you first make that pro style jump, you already have to have your two mechanics because it's relatively complicated, and your old man and his friend can't do it. And then you'll have a full-time engineer as well, straight out of the box. Whereas obviously the whole way up the karting ranks, you don't have them.
Yeah.
No, for sure.
I think in national level championships across the world, I think a lot of the guys, you know, one of the boys that always springs to mind, and he's a great lad, is Phil Crow.
You know, he's on the track there, I did last week, actually.
He's absolutely brilliant. He's mental.
Is he?
he for me was like the essence of stock 1000 racing.
And
stock racing in Britain. He'd turn up in his van, he'd pull his BM out the back and just go ride the wheels off it and win. And I remember watching him win at Brands in the pouring wet and just thinking, what a man. You know, he's turned up in his van, got his bike out and just won the race at British Championship. It was great. But yeah, it's definitely, you can extend that period of doing it yourself, which can save a lot of funds. But I think one of the difficult things is going, okay, right, when do we stop that saving money attitude and change that to, right, we're going to invest and push forward with the team?
I think that's the point, isn't it, of like when people fall by the wayside or they then make a breakthrough. It's whether they can manage to do that. That's that point, I think, isn't it, in people's careers, which is like a sticking point. But, you know, people do it. Some people break through, have the right people around them, and some fall away, unfortunately. But that's like, you know, the cutthroat part of the game, isn't it?
Mm. And in 2016, when you joined a team in the same championship, you know, what were the biggest things you noticed that year?
So the biggest things were, I was still using my own bike. So I was riding for CP Motorsport based in Portsmouth. So they were running a ZX6 in Supersport, and then they were running me in Superstock again on my own ZX6. But the biggest thing was I was coming in and debriefing properly with a crew chief. So it was John Crockford, his name was, and he's got previous experience in British Superbikes, rode for Crescents, and, you know, he's a good rider in his day. So relaying information, and then based off the feedback I'd given, he'd make the right adjustments to the bike. And it was like immediate difference. I won my first race for the first weekend out with the team. It was like, wow, you know, it was worth investing that little bit more money because we've just gone and won, stuck it on pole and won our first race of the year. It was like, right, this is where we need to be at. So it was like a bit of a light bulb moment, really. You just kept pushing with that, to be fair. But yeah, the biggest difference was having more people around you and being able to talk to someone who could make the right adjustments to the bike based off the feedback you were given. Just a crew chief, you know, someone to take that lead role.
Yeah.
With the crew chief thing, you mentioned that your crew chief at that point was actually an ex-rider as well. I've had a few engineers, for example, that have done, I wouldn't say super high level stuff, but they've actually raced a little bit, so they understand car dynamics. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's quite important, or is a benefit if, say, you've got a crew chief, as you call them, that has had bike experience? Do you reckon that really helps the relationship between driver and rider?
I think it definitely helps, yeah. And I think the biggest thing is not just knowledge, but just things you might say, you know, chatter, or I can't turn the bike in, or the front feels high, stuff like things like this. A person that's ridden or raced can, you know, can think about that and understand exactly what you mean. Because like my crew chief that I've had for the last 3-4 years and who I'll be working again with this year, he's done a bit of racing, you know, he's ridden on the road, does a bit. And he knows exactly what I mean based off, because he knows what I'm saying in relation to what I'm feeling. So I think, yeah, having a crew chief or someone around you that has a bit of experience definitely helps. But I do know there is people out there that have not raced at all, can't even really ride a bike, but can set a bike up, you know, so well that, you know, they just don't know how they do it. They've just got that understanding, I suppose.
Yeah, that's interesting, but it's clicked back into my mind. So I drove for a World Series Renault team back in 2011 called Pons, who's Sito Pons. Okay. And the guy that ran me was a guy called Chu Sanchez, who also was a crew chief for Pons's race team. And I think he was on, I think Pons has a son or had a son that raced in Moto2 at the time for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
Two of them.
Two of them.
Okay, so the older one, he was running him the year after, so it would have been 2012 2013.
Axel, his name was
Axel. That's the guy. Yeah,
he's finished racing. He finished racing and is now a model.
Okay,
I couldn't remember which one it was.
Yeah, Axel's the model. Very good looking. I've just got to say that because he's a model, but
yeah, fair play. But this guy, anyway, this crew chief slash engineer engineered Heikki Kovalainen. And mm-hmm. Actually, when he did World Series Renault, then he engineered me, so he actually came down a level in driver, unfortunately for him, and had to put up with me. But no, he was really, like, really flipping good, and it's interesting from my point of view anyway, that he was so good. I mean, the car he gave me when I first jumped into it was unbelievable, and I don't know if I've ever driven a better car throughout a whole race stint than what he gave me.
Wow.
But then he was super good on the bikes as well, and I don't think he raced bikes before. He was more
just had that understanding of how things work, geometry, exactly. Balance, that sort of thing.
Exactly.
Crazy, so isn't it?
Really crazy, yeah.
Nick, we have lots. So when we're debriefing and talking to crew chiefs about setup, bike riders have lots of different ways of describing. And
I see you doing this a lot.
Yeah, you see
there's a lot of hand gestures.
Yeah, if you ever seen the Alpine Stars did a video with like all the Alpine Stars riders, and they were like, how do you explain this, and you just see them all going
with the chatter in front, I guess.
Are there like certain ways you describe how the car feels and is behaving through hand gestures or noises or
I'm not going to do the noises for you.
You've got to do the noises.
But mostly, it's obviously, we talk about platform because they're much more aerodynamically advanced than a bike because we actually have a floor underneath that we can utilize in terms of setting it up with. Mm-hmm. Now you've learned a bit more rake, less rake, high downforce, low downforce.
I understand.
Obviously, you have your understeer or oversteer because you've got two wheels that slip at the front. I don't know how you would describe understeer or oversteer. I guess it's still a similar sort of thing, but you may use a different terminology. Mm-hmm.
Understeer is a crash.
Understeer is a big one. It's a Marquez that you can't save, I guess.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's how we talk about it mostly. So I guess the difference is that we talk about aero and an aero platform in particular a lot more than you boys would. Mm-hmm. And then because there's a bigger space at the front as well, sometimes you can have more than one spring, or you have two springs that are further space away than just on a bike chassis. Two front anti-roll bars, same with the rear, and then you've got your standard toe-in, toe-out geometries, like I said, mentioned ride heights, springs, dampers that you can change both front to rear. So I presume all that kind of stuff is similar. But so how would you explain, say, if you've got traction issues, oversteer through a corner, what would you say? I've got oversteer or what?
Go on, Brad.
Fall off high side.
I've got over the bars and I'm in the gravel.
Come down with snow on my head.
Yeah, exactly. I think, yeah, oversteer like for us would just be, you know, I think before you get oversteer on a bike, you've got two ways you can look at oversteer. I think the first one is spinning of the rear tire. Mm. You know, you're getting on the power and before the bike's oversteering, you're losing traction.
Yeah, and that's if you keep it on, then you'll get the high side.
And then if you keep it on and shut off and it grips, then you get sense.
That's the biggest thing, isn't it? It's snapping that throttle off. Once it slows, if you just let go of the throttle, it will ping. But if you just hold a little bit, don't let it right off, you'll almost like ride out of it. I can imagine a bit like if you're drifting a car. Just keep it on a bit of throttle, you'll end up driving out of it and catch grip again.
Yeah, exactly. If you do an aggressive motion, whether it be anything, if you nail the brakes, obviously you then pitch the car, which will make you spin faster. Or if you lift, then you let the rear come like this and then you spin even faster. So, it's all about dynamics, both on two and four wheels.
Go on, Brad.
I was just going to say, like, Nick, so when you jump in a car, do you find within like 3-4 laps, you know, maybe what changes might need to be? Whether it be geometry or balance, all that sort of thing, can you know within literally a short amount of laps?
Yeah, so if it's, so say if we're doing, so recently we've been developing the new BMW M4 and we've been running in this case with heated tires. So your first two, you're straight out and straight on it and you can do your fastest lap if you really get on with it, even on lap one.
Yeah.
So you can literally, say if you made a spring change or a rear bar change, you could know within two laps 100% that maybe you've gone too far or you need another similar change again.
Yeah.
Or maybe you want to reset that bar and try a different tuning tool, whether it be less rear wing, different rake, ride height. Whereas I guess with you boys, confidence must be having two wheels, not four. Yeah. Confidence to build up to the same level each time must take longer than, I've got one or two laps, because getting the inside of the tire warm and then the confidence in that front's going to bite must take for ages, because I'd be, excuse my French, shitting myself for a long, long time.
I always feel for me like the first session of the weekend, is always about building. But I find once you get into qualifying in the end of the race, you know, if you make a change, you know within a lap whether you've done the right thing or not. Mm. And with how good the tires are, how good tire warmers are, you can pretty much go straight out of pit lane and almost go as hard as you want. Do you know what I mean? Within reason. But especially after one out lap, you can go hard straight away. As long as the tires have been up to temperature for the right amount of time and they're pressured properly, you know, the way how advanced tires are and tire warmers it's impressive, really. Mm. Scary at times, but you can do it.
I bet that is scary. Because so do you ever have, I don't know about the bike tires so much, so again it can be for the listeners, so say on a Michelin tire we have the shiny coating on the top, so do you guys have to scrub that off or do you not have it at all, or what do you have on a bike tire?
It doesn't seem that, like, the bike tire is shiny, but it doesn't for me, and I've never had to experience scrubbing a tire in effectively. I've always found in a qualifying session for me is I'll come in halfway through and I'll put another brand new rear tire in and I'll go straight out within one out lap, I'll be straight on to my fastest lap of the session. So you don't have to worry about scrubbing it so much. It seems to give you that grip straight away. Again, as long as it's pressured and up to heat properly, there's no reason why you need to scrub it. But, you know, I've seen some tires always look shinier than others. I suppose it's that like release and aging within the mold when they produce a tire or something, but it never seems to give lack of grip. Well, I don't know about you, Alex. Have you ever experienced any of that?
I think by the time you get to the final corner and you're pinning it on the exit to start your lap, it's scrubbed in.
Yeah.
I think if you're rolling off, you know, the only time I've ever felt like maybe a little bit of movement from like a new tire would be, you know, when you come out of pit lane, you bank into that first corner, you can just feel the bike sit into the tire almost. And it's just literally like a bob. And you just feel like, oh, it's just where, that's it. And
that's it. It's gone in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's really, really straight away, to be honest.
Yeah. So we find that definitely on the heated tires, but a lot of the time with the car racing, we don't use, so on a Pirelli tire, say in the championship I'm racing, which is GT Masters, we will not use tire heaters. Mm-hmm. So we're having to bring them up. And then those edges really need to be probably the hottest point of the tire just to try and get them in so you can actually create load to then bring the core temperature through. Whereas if you're running tire warmers, then yes, you can get on with it kind of straight away. So yeah, I didn't take into account that you guys are always using tire warmers.
Yeah,
I missed that point as well. I always thought that you guys would always use tire warmers. I never thought that you'd run, but yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah, if we were to go out on a cold tire, you wouldn't get past turn two.
No, exactly. It'd have to be super slow, right?
If I'm training on the super moto bike, and it's a kart track and it's, you know, decent weather, I just don't bother with tire warmers. But I then have to take two or three laps of consecutive pace building to get it up to temperature to then create the grip. Because if I went out turn one, threw it in, I'd just
be where
I normally am in the gravel.
I want to get there later
in the day. So I was going to ask you, Brad, like we talked about being like, you know, feeling new tires. Because riders generally, Nick, fall into one of two categories. You make a change to the bike, they're like, it's a bike, I don't feel any difference, you know, they'll just ride it hard. And then you get people a bit more like myself. I'm very susceptible to changes and
sensitive.
Sensitive in one respect.
Yeah, exactly. In his heart and in his riding style.
Stop it. Brad, are you somebody who really feels the change your crew chief makes, or do you just sort of have the attitude, just going to get on, ride hard?
Again, yeah, I'm probably a sensitive rider in that respect.
That's nice.
No, like my crew chief, he can make a small change, even like on the R6, like half a mil of ride height in the rear, which half a mil sounds nothing, but I would know that he's done it. I'd be able to tell you the difference straight away.
Yeah.
Which I think in one aspect, having loads of feeling is a good thing. And then in another aspect, it's sometimes you can be too fussy, you know, you're sort of looking for something that's not really there sometimes. So you've got as a rider, I always feel like you've got to draw the line somewhere and just take it for what it is. It's a happy medium. I can imagine in a car, like anything, it's always a compromise, I would have thought.
Yeah, you're completely right. And again, you have two different type of drivers. So you have the people that, I'm one of them, but will actually just drive anything. I don't care. If he's going oversteer, all right, then whatever. Then if he's going to steer, okay, well, I have to drive differently. And actually racing in Porsche Super Cup taught me that, because you have no traction control, no ABS anyway, and the car is very difficult to drive. So you have to just adapt. But then also driving in endurance races, you have two or three drivers. And say if someone or one of those drivers is a little bit more sensitive, like you two guys, then you have to maybe cater to their needs. So if they really hate oversteer, then I'm happy to just say, okay, we'll dial it out, you do it, and then I'll just drive it. So that's how we kind of deal with it. But again, sensitivity can't be as much as a bike rider, because the limits you guys are on, I feel that you have to be closer to the limit to be fast. and the danger aspect of it. It's like pushing it to that limit. I know you're both lunatics, but it's still got to be some thought, like when you're tipping it into, say, Cops at Silverstone, and you know that the bike's a bit loose, that if you are sensitive, you're going to feel that extra little wiggle over the bump on the entry a bit more than, say, someone else that isn't. And then you have to make sure that that's right, so you can really, you know, maximize and execute your quali lap.
Yeah, exactly. For me, in a weekend, it's like free practice one, free practice two, qualifying. I always try to dial out these little things, whether it be bumps, turning, this, that. But then when I get to the race and I'm in the battle, it's almost like it is what it is. And what my feeling almost goes out the window, and it's just all about going forward. So I think it's being able to turn that on and off can be quite difficult. And sometimes, as I said before, I have been too fussy in the past, and I've had to learn from that. You know, the crew chief basically, you know, has to tell me, you're looking for something that's not there, it's going to be bumpy here, just ride it. And that's how it is. So you learn from that, which is important. So
yeah, it's like a lot of the time you'll get, you've done your free practices, you've done your quality lap, and then you get into the race, and you finish the race and you go to crew chief, oh, that felt really, you know, the bike felt crap. Like, what was going on? And then you look, sit down in the evening, and he goes, well, you were braking harder, you were braking later, you were going faster. There's all these like different.
And you weren't on the new tire like quali.
Exactly.
Yeah, less grip.
Exactly. And but then if you can't switch that off completely, like the first time that really happened to me was when I first raced at Imola, and we sat down. I had a really good Friday and got into Super Pole, and we sat down on the Saturday night before the race, and I was like, I'm just not happy. And the guy I was working with at Toth, and we'll talk about Toth in a minute, Brad. Mm-hmm. He said to me, Alex, just race tomorrow. Just race. You don't think about the bike. Don't think about what you're doing. Just race. And, you know, really helped. And
there's a lot to be said for that, and it's too true.
Yeah. Sometimes you've got to switch off. I think.
Yeah, you have.
No matter what form of racing, you've got to switch off.
And that's when you're going to be your fastest, though, because if you're over analyzing, thinking, I need to, you know, pinch the brakes, 2 bar here extra, and roll off, and you're not going to be as fast. At some point, you have to let the subconscious natural talent that you've obviously built up over X amount of years just crack on. And that's when you'll be at one and be able to get in that rhythm and do the consistent laps, in my opinion, anyway. So,
for sure.
For sure. And that's quite, you know, me and Brad have actually both rode for the same team at some point. So, Team Toth, big long history in Grand Prix racing, and now in the World Supersport 300 Championship, and now in World Supersport. And you did your wild card with them in Qatar.
How did
you find that experience?
Oh, Qatar was like one of the highlights of 2019. I think, as I said earlier, 2019 was like a standout year for me, and that was one of the reasons. To be able to get out to Qatar, do the round there, and just experience different temperatures, different climate, a much better and bigger track than we would get here. Just the whole thing, really. Riding at night, obviously, is something that we don't really do here either.
Yeah, what do you think? I rode there the year before, and everyone was like, oh, watch out for the shadows. Watch out for the shadows. But as you're going into the corner, obviously you've got the lights around you, and your shadow overtakes you sometimes going into the corner, and you go, oh, what's that? Oh, it's just my shadow.
Yeah, because it always feels like someone's coming in 100 mph faster than you from behind, and it's just going to tailgate you, but actually it's yourself. You look around, you're all by yourself, there's no one around you, which is weird, but I think that you're probably the same. You soon get your head around that. But the climate there when I rode was unbelievably humid, which was really tough, which the race was tough. I did suffer with the humidity, but again, that was an experience in itself. So yeah, the whole thing was good. Yeah, I enjoyed it massively.
Because in the boxes there, in the garages in Qatar, they have air conditioning.
That's a godsend. Absolute godsend. That's where you found me all weekend if I went on the bike.
I know. You come in from, like, say you're midway through practice and you sit down in the box and it's like, Well, it's nice in here.
Yeah, nice and chilled.
Yeah, do we really want to go back into the sweat outside? But
yeah, it's tough.
Did you know what was like your biggest perception of world championship racing in a different country then?
It was really good. Obviously, the reason the whole Qatar thing came around is because I did the British World Superbike around Donington Park as a wild card with my current team at the time, which was Appleyards, and we had a really strong weekend. I finished ninth, which was really good. Mm. So the whole thing came around based off that, because my sort of outlook for 2020 was to do World Super Sport, and TOF was a potential option, this and that. So the whole idea came around good. So that was the main reason to go to Qatar, was to experience the team, experience another race at a World Championship level, and then, you know, look at the options year after. But World Championship, my biggest thing is that it's just that little bit extra. British Championship or British Super Sport is at a really high level.
Yeah,
but World Championships, just that next bit again. You know, you need to learn that next bit again and be prepared to push that a little bit more, which is what I found. And a bit like when I did my first Superstock wild card in 2014, it was like once I'd done the World Super Sport wild card at 2019 at Donington, my level of where I was at was definitely greater after I'd done the race at Donington. And that, again, I felt that helped the second half of my 2019 season, that's for sure. So it's just that next level. And I'd imagine you find that across, you know, car racing, is you always get that next step until you get to F1. There's always some that next level again.
Yeah, no, you're completely right. For me, it was when I went to Europe for the first time and raced out in the European Series. That's when you get, yeah, basically anyone that's anyone. Coming in is basically a world championship, but just the junior levels, and the level was a chunk higher than British. I did a kind of a one-off Euro Cup race, so same car but just in Europe.
Okay.
And I remember doing that first weekend, and like the way the tire came in, how they attacked on their first quali laps and everything was just slightly different, and that really gave me some ideas of when I went back to the UK, and I was actually better for it. So I think when you are thrown in the deep end a little bit with these good guys that have been racing in said championship for a while, it's quite interesting to see how someone gets on and then how they learn and take it back to what championship they're actually racing in.
It's interesting you say about the whole tyre thing, because the race at Donington, the World Cup, I qualified fifth, which was really good.
Yeah, I was off at the front. That was incredible. Yeah, awesome.
I was off at the front. I was like in a position to battle for the podium, and I'm thinking, this is too good to be true, but we'll go with it. So we're going with it. And then they just start gapping. And what I found was they were just conserving a bit of tyre, whereas I was going everything I had at the time. Yeah. Which is why I ended up going, I think I got up to fourth was the highest place, and ended up finishing ninth. So that's the same whole thing with the tyre, learning how they manage it, which is, again, I suppose that next level and being experienced, and, you know, that's the level they're at, really.
Yeah, it's super cool head as well.
Yeah, exactly.
They could be a bit older as well, which I mean, I don't know actually the exact age of you boys, but if I compare myself now at 30 to my experience when I was 24, 25, now so much more calm when I go into a race weekend, and I know I have to execute, because you've done it that many more times. Although you think you know it all at 24, 25, you actually don't.
Yeah.
Unless you actually happen or whoever, you know, some freak of nature, or someone that's probably done more racing than I ever have in my whole life, but he's younger. It really helps with that, piecing each bit together and knowing when to say lay it all on the line, or when to just say, I'll give myself 5% here.
Yeah, no, I think that you've hit the nail on the head there, to be fair. It's all about experience, isn't it? You always find it's like people in World Super Sport level at the moment. You often look at the names, and a lot of them have been doing that for a while. Your Jules Glazel, he stands out for one. Caracasulo, people like that, you know, they've got a lot of experience in that field. So, you know, they know a lot more than I do, which is the same as what you've experienced before. So, yeah, again, cross-reference there, isn't there?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, I think it's one of the biggest things at World Championship is the depth of absolute savages on the grid.
Yeah.
And they can just step it up when they need to and when they want to, which is quite scary.
Mm, oh, yeah.
Just, It's like, oh yeah, you know, I remember in Qatar, we were on very different bikes, me and Sandro Cortese, who won the world championship he was phenomenal on a super sport bike. And it was like, I was like, followed him for a couple of quarters, I was thinking, hey, you know what, I'm all right here. And then I realized he was probably on his outlap, but
onwards.
Yeah, exactly. But no, those boys in World Super Sport are some cool customers, and they're very, very quick indeed. But Brad, you're going to be up against some good talent this year.
Yeah, obviously this year, stepping up to the superbikes, which has always been the goal. So when I sort of started back in 2010, so
yeah,
that's always been the goal, you know. And at the time when I first started, it seemed unrealistic, really. But as things have progressed, it's sort of become more and more likely. And yeah, now we're here. I need to make the most of it. Like you said, it's going to be some strong competition. Lots of riders with lots of experience, like we've talked about. So yeah, I just go in as a rookie, totally open-minded with no expectations. And it's like doing your apprenticeship all over again. That's where I'm at now. So just need to take me time. I think that's the biggest thing, and, you know, see where we're at.
Yeah. And you've, are you teammates with Joe Francis this year?
Yeah, Joe Francis. Yeah. So he's rode with the PR racing team now this will be his third season in Superbike. So we must be the same age. I think we're very similar. So I'm 23. He's very similar age. So yeah, teammates. So I hopefully benefit from his experience, as long, you know, hopefully we'll work together as teammates. So yeah, look forward to get going, really.
Sorry, to have a reference though, isn't it? Because when you're jumping into a new championship, particularly first year, you've got someone that knows a team, and say you can listen to how he communicates and reports back from the bike, because you're going to be quite new to it, and how then the team communicates back to him in terms of what they want from each other should speed up the process. And also, I presume you're still in touch. I see you're good friends, or relatively good friends, with Scott Redding, who was obviously pretty successful in that championship. So you can lean on him a little bit in terms of, yeah, just maybe some track knowledge or some racing knowledge as well.
Yeah, that's it. I think, you know, people like Scott and other people that I know, drawing any information out of them to help me progress, you know, a little bit quicker as a rookie, is, you know, really quite important, to be fair. And people, you know, that I speak to, they just give little snippets of information which you build up and you try. And I found that in the past in Supersport, people that I've spoke to who've got good experience, you just take what they say and you do it, and it does make a big difference. So yeah, getting valuable information from the teammate is quite important, because we're going to have similar feedback on our initial feelings, for sure. So based off what the team have learned from a rookie coming in as well, is quite cool, because there's some teams out there have never had a rookie coming in and coming up through. So the team have got that, you know, they've worked with a rookie rider before, and they've, you know, they've made a rookie rider progress. So
yeah, it's
good to have that knowledge from the team themselves. And again, people like Scott and people like that, you know, it's all good, valuable information.
And finally, just, you know, to round off, it's an exciting year because it's a brand new bike as well. It's the new M1000RR, which we've seen has been going really well in World Superbike testing. So that must be
BMW. So it's the right brand.
It's got to be the way forward. And it's an M, you know.
And
they don't make M's for nothing. So it's going to be a proper bit of kit.
Exactly. So we've seen it been going really well in World Superbike testing at the hands of Jonas Folger, Tom Sykes, Michael Vandermark. So that, you know, that must give you added confidence going into this year.
Yeah, because, you know, you look at the BMW, because last year the BMW was a relatively new package, and in superbike form, you would say it's obvious it wasn't the strongest package. So this is why BMW have brought out the M version. It's purely for racing purposes. And then, you know, BMW have said themselves, they haven't made this M. They haven't made it. This is the first time they've done it on the bike scene.
Yeah.
You know, you've got your M4s, your M3s, and so on. But they've made this the M version. So it's curing and fixing the areas where they struggled last year. So it's a winning package in World Superbikes, British Superbikes, World Endurance for this year. So you know, their BMW aren't messing around this year, that's for sure. And I think we'll start to see that in World Superbikes once they get going shortly. So it's going to be interesting to see how it performs.
Exactly. And, yeah. You know, we've got, as you said, World Endurance. They've got a really strong factory lineup there with the likes of Xavi Forres, I think Marcus Reiterberger, mm-hmm. World Endurance. You know, so that's covering that championship, the World Superbike Championship. They've got the factory team with Sykes and Vandermark. Then you've got Laverty on a factory-supported private team. And then you've also got Jonas Folger on the same. And then BSB, how many of you are there on this new M1000?
I think there's eight new M1000s on the grid this year. So there's quite a few.
That's awesome.
I would imagine, that would be the most one manufacturer on the grid, I would have thought. Maybe Kawasaki.
Yeah, really pushing it hard. I mean, I know Marcus Flash, who's head of or CEO of BMW M, so technically my boss, he's really into his bikes as well and rides bikes quite often. Mm-hmm. So there's been a big push. Obviously, we have the M4 GT3 coming next year. It's already been developed now, but also it seems like there's been a big push on the bike side as well, which is really good to see.
Yeah, with the interviews I've seen with, what was the guy's name again?
Marcus Flash.
Yeah, I've seen some interviews with him and he's really positive and keen. And it seems to be pushing this new M1000. So, as I've said, they're not messing around. I think it's going to be a proper bit of kit that will be definitely capable of winning, which is exciting for me because I know I'm going to be on a good package.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Well, I think then we should leave it there, boys. Thank you very much for coming on, Brad. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Good chat for ages. Really, really interesting. And I'll have to try and get out to some of the races with Alex or whoever and cheer you on as and when we can.
For sure.
So, thanks again for coming on and to our listeners as well for listening in to the HYM podcast. Make sure you get in the comments, like and subscribe. Tell us what you think about this style four-wheel to two-wheel comparison as it's our first one so far. I really enjoyed it personally. And of course, get following Brad. I think Brad's Instagram is BradJones12. Make sure you, liking all his photos, following his journey in the British Superbikes and, of course, BMW as well. So thanks for coming on, mate. And thanks again for everyone for listening. See you soon.
Cheers, guys.